We know there are times where you're just too busy to sort through the mass of information that comes your way. So to make it easier for you to stay informed, subscribe to The Morning Agenda, WITF's news podcast, where the only agenda is you.
Funding for The Spark is provided by Capital Blue Cross, focused on creating a healthier future for our communities through innovations like its Capital Blue Cross Connect Health and Wellness Centers, which provide in-person services and inspire healthy living. Learn more at capitalbluecross.com. The Spark is also supported by UPMC. Choose UPMC for your family's health care needs close to home. Visit upmc.com/centralPA for a complete list of services and locations.
Welcome to The Spark. I'm Scott Lamar. After 13 years of hosting The Spark, and before that its predecessor, Smart Talk, I'm retiring from WITF. All this week, we're airing a few memorable programs I've hosted. Today, we go back to September 17th, 2019. Our guest was Sue Klebold, mother of Dylan Klebold. Dylan Klebold and Eric Harris killed 12 students and a teacher and wounded 24 others before taking their own lives at Columbine High School in Littleton, Colorado, on April 20th, 1999. There have been many mass shootings since, but Columbine seems to have a distinctive place in the nation's history. Sue Klebold wrote a book called A Mother's Reckoning, Living in the Aftermath of Tragedy, in 2016. On this 2019 program, we spoke about the book, her son, and the shooting. Tell us about Dylan's childhood. What kind of kid was he?
I could talk a long, long time about his childhood. He was born into a family of parents that had been married a long time, a first and only marriage. He had a three-year-old brother at the time that Dylan was born. We lived in Littleton, Colorado. Both of us were educated people. We both have master's degrees. I worked in the community college system as a teacher and an administrator. And Dylan was a precious, beloved, precocious kid. I have so many memories of him, of just being this, he was like my sunshine boy. He had blonde, thick, wavy hair. He had blue eyes. He loved to learn new things. He was inquisitive and intelligent. He learned so easily. I don't think, you know, as a teacher, I just delighted in how easily he learned things. He, even as a little child, when he was an infant and still had diapers on, I remember him sitting on the floor with me and playing with Tinker Toys. And he was too young for Tinker Toys, but he lined up all the sticks in order of their color. And he was very linear and structured in his thinking. And of course, I love that because I was a teacher myself, and I thought this is going to be an academic person. This is going to be somebody who loves to learn. And he did. I marveled at the things he picked up. He learned how to make equations on the refrigerator with a little magnet set when he was three. I mean, he just asked me what the equal sign and the plus sign meant, and I got out pinto beans and showed him what they meant. You know, this means you push them together and count them again. And then he started doing equations on the refrigerator, and, you know, 2 + 5 = 7, and he knew that instantly. I didn't have to do any explaining. He delighted in everything that was new as he grew. I mean, he was this kid. He loved collections. He loved origami. He liked things that were kind of engineering related. He was a Lego maniac. And he was the kind of kid that would get a Lego set and follow the construction of a project to the very end, piece by piece, whereas my other son was more creative and less apt to follow directions. And so it was a very interesting contrast to see the two boys. Dylan always had lots of friends. He did well in school. He never had any diagnosed learning problems or behavioral problems.
He was well-behaved growing up?
Oh, yes. Yeah, he was very well-behaved. Extremely well-behaved. In fact, to manage his behavior, he was very easy to manage. You could usually reason with him and explain something, and that would usually adjust his behavior accordingly.
But from what I understand, he was a perfectionist, and he would get upset if things didn't go exactly, I won't say like he wanted, but if you said you explained things to him, but that he wanted things to be perfect.
Right. And I noticed that when he got a little older and we would start to play family games together. One of the things I remember is it was very hard for him to lose, even when he was in third grade or up to almost fourth grade. He would get very upset with himself and he would, you know, stomp away from a game. And I remember, you know, thinking when he was able to manage that behavior, that it was an achievement. Like, but I do think that he was sensitive and he was shy. He didn't like attention being drawn to himself. You know, one day my husband came home with a movie camera. It was something we'd never had before. And Dylan was about in second grade. And I remember him filming the kids and Dylan just froze and didn't know what to do. He was so self-conscious. He didn't want to be in the spotlight. And I remember him opening the door behind him and, you know, slamming it and running down the hall because he just didn't want to be on camera.
Would you describe your home as loving, nurturing?
I would, and I've gotten feedback from those who had visited that they perceived it the same way. But yes, I do and did perceive it that way.
So was Dylan ever in any trouble?
Dylan was never in any trouble until he got to be in high school. And it was such a shock. When he was in junior high, he had a cluster of trouble out of the blue. It was something that I didn't understand. He got in trouble in different ways all around the same time. One was he and his friend Eric, who ultimately did the shootings with him, stole something from a van that was parked down the road from us. And about that time, he got in trouble at school for scratching a locker. And he got in trouble for hacking into the computer system at school. One of his friends wanted to get locker combinations so he could leave a note in the locker of his girlfriend's ex-boyfriend. And Dylan was involved in that, for which he was suspended from school. And after this cluster of trouble, I was alarmed and concerned. But I didn't know then what I know now. And I know now that a dramatic change in behavior might be an indication that some kind of mental issues are beginning. And I was concerned. I remember asking people we knew. Dylan required a lawyer at that time because he'd broken the law. I asked the lawyer. I remember asking the diversion counselor because he was put in a diversion program. Does this mean something? You know, should I be doing? Does he need counseling? And at that time, people didn't really understand that that might be an indicator of something really going awry. The diversion counselor asked him, you know, Dylan, do you think you need counseling? And of course, a 17-year-old boy would respond, no, I don't think I do. He's, you know, and I asked him why he did this, how he did it. He said, I don't know how I did it. It was just this impulse, and suddenly we were doing it. And I said, well, you know, this scared me. And he said, well, it scared me too. And so there were, you know, consequences at home and, you know, taking his privileges away and going through diversion and doing the things that parents do. But I never at that time understood the importance of connecting with him emotionally after that. I was so focused on, we're going to get your life back on track. You're going to do this. We're going to do this. I never really checked in with him to say, what is happening? How are you feeling? What is your personal experience in all this? And this is why I speak and why I talk, is to let people know that something such as a change in behavior can be indicative of a really severe change in one's thinking. But at that point in Dylan's life, he said, I promise you I will get my life on track. I'm going to get things back in order. And being very focused on order and structure, that's exactly what he did. The last year of his life, he did everything right. I mean, he went back to school and he was fine and he had a job and he did the sound technician role for the school plays. And he got accepted into four colleges, including the university of his choice. We'd gone on a college visiting trip just a few weeks before the shootings. From what I could see as a parent, he had focused on getting his life back in order. But what I didn't know was that there was great deterioration going on in his thinking.
Take us back to April 20th, 1999. Was there anything out of the ordinary in the days leading up to April 20th?
In the days leading up to April 20th, I'll go back a few weeks. We had gotten the school had contacted us because it was time for teacher conferences at the end. Dylan was a graduating senior, and we got a call from his English teacher saying that that his grades were slipping in an English class, and could we come in? And we did. My husband and I both came in. And when we got there, my concern was, you know, what hasn't he done? What does he need to turn in? And at that meeting, the teacher said, no, he's caught up. That's not a problem. But I want you to know that he wrote a paper that was disturbing. Now, she didn't have the paper with her. We did not see it. She alluded to the fact that it was dark and had bad language in it. And as a parent, I'm thinking, well, what does this mean? You know, this is an expression. It's a creative expression. It didn't alarm me because knowing Dylan, I didn't think he was anyone who would be having any thoughts, any dark thoughts. I didn't even have that on my mind. We did not see the paper. We talked about it. She didn't know what to do. We didn't know what to do. Nowadays, if a student writes a paper and that paper was about witnessing a murder, it was very dark, it had bad language. Nowadays, there might be a threat assessment protocol in a school, and if someone would be talked to if they had something like that. But 20 years ago, there was not. And she referred us to the school counselor and referred him to the school counselor. The school counselor said, Dylan, you know you're not allowed to write a paper with bad words in it. And Dylan said, I know. And he said, well, don't do it again, okay? And Dylan said, okay. So that was the preceding couple of weeks.
3 days before April 20th, Dylan actually went to the prom.
Dylan was moving forward with his life in every positive way. The weekend before the shootings were, it was a very happy time. On Friday, the shootings occurred on a Tuesday. That Friday, Dylan picked out a dorm room for college. He measured the square footage with my husband. We wrote a check and mailed it in because he was making plans for the future. And that weekend was the prom where he went with his friends out to dinner and dancing. And he talked about his future. He came home early that night, early in the morning, the next morning, and I talked with him. And he thanked me for sending him and said, I've had the greatest time of my life. You know, thank you so much for sending me. It was wonderful. And I went to bed that night thinking everything was great. And 3 days later were the shootings.
On that morning, April 20th, Dylan left for school a little bit early.
Yes.
What were the last words he said to you?
He said only one word to me. He got up early in the dark, and I heard him bounding down the stairs, and it was before he had to be gone. And we always talked in the morning and got, you know, adjusted on who was going to be where and when we would connect again. And I didn't understand why he was up so early. And I remember opening my bedroom door, and the house was black, pitch black. It was dark. It was before dawn. And I called his name because he thundered past my bedroom door, and I said, Dill? And then I heard the front door open, and all he said was, bye. And then he slammed the door and was gone. And I was disturbed. I remember waking up my husband saying, did you hear that? What's with him? What's going on? And over the weekend, my husband had said to me, does Dylan seem tense to you? His voice is higher than usual. And I remember thinking, I didn't notice that, but he's got all the prom and all these things going on. Maybe he's just stressed. And when that happened, my thought was, he must be having some problem with a friend. Maybe he's going to, you know, talk with somebody, have coffee early. I had no idea that we were in a life and death situation. I just knew that he was upset about something. And I asked my husband, you know, would you be sure to talk to him when he gets home from school today and figure out what's going on? And Tom said, of course. And that was the day of the shootings.
So we're talking about the day that the shooting occurred. How did you find out about the shooting?
I had gone to work that morning without worrying significantly. I thought Dylan was going to talk to Tom. Whatever the issue was, it would be clear.
Tom, your husband.
Tom was my husband, yes. And and I got to work. I just got involved in my work day. And then about noon, I was preparing to go to a meeting on one of our college campuses because I work for the community college system. And I was away from my desk getting ready. And I came back to my desk, and the message light was flashing on my phone. And it was a message from my husband, and his voice sounded horrible. It was cracked and ragged and breathless. And all he said was, Susan, this is an emergency. Call me back immediately. And I knew in that instant that something had happened to one of our children, because nothing could make his voice sound like that. I called him back, and he was totally distracted, breathless. And all he said to me was, listen to the television. And I started to yell, I'm at work, I can't listen to the television. But he put the phone up against the TV, and I heard nothing. I just, you know, heard noise. I couldn't tell what I was hearing. He got back on the phone, and he said, you know, he just blurted out, there's a shooting at the school. There are gunmen in trench coats that are shooting at people. Dylan's friends don't know where he is. They think it may be Dylan and Eric, and just, you know, tumbling words. And I didn't even say anything else. I just said, I'm coming home right now. I hung up the phone. I left my cubicle. I had someone cancel my meeting. I got on the elevator, and I drove home. And it was a long drive. It was a 26-mile drive. And my mind was just racing. I didn't have the radio on because I wanted to drive safely, and I was so distracted. But I was, you know, crying and hyperventilating and thinking, could Dylan be hurt? Could this be someone else hurting him? Could this be something that had done like a prank? Because he did mention to me in the weeks preceding this day that there was going to be a senior prank. And I said to him, don't be involved in any prank, because you just got off of a diversion program and you could end up with a felony on your record. You know, don't be involved. And he'd said, don't worry, I won't get into trouble, I promise. And so I'm thinking, was this prank that they had talked about? And then when I got home, it was just kind of chaotic. My husband's had contacted an attorney. He'd found someone, because Dylan would have needed an attorney, whatever the outcome of this was, if he had done some kind of a prank and he were in trouble. He said, the police are coming. Our son was going to come from his job to the house to be with us.
Your older son.
My older son. And, you know, it was just a day of a complete shock, disbelief, not understanding what was happening. I didn't really learn what was happening. I could hear a little bit on the radio. I heard that 25 people were dead, that I kept asking the police, is my son okay? Finally, that afternoon, one of the SWAT team guys, you know, I think took pity on me and just said, yes, he is. And I said, how did he die? Yes, he is. My son is dead. Because I kept asking, is Dylan alive? Is my son okay? And finally, someone said, yes, he is dead. And I said, how did he die? And he said, I don't know. So at that point, you know, we were asked to evacuate. And it just began this, you know, years, months, days, years of confusion and agony and, you know, horrible.
In the days afterwards, you had a hard time believing that Dylan could have hurt anyone under his own will. Tell us about that.
I had a whole set of beliefs about who Dylan was and who I was and who our family was. And it was so impossible for me to believe that Dylan was capable of hurting anyone else. Dylan, from what I could see and from what his friends knew him to be, was a gentle, soft-spoken kid. He was very quiet. You know, he was the kind of guy that would stop and help somebody get a can of gas on the road, which he did not long before he died. He was just it was just not someone you'd expect to do anything to hurt anyone. So I was very much in denial for a long time. I believed, as many of his friends did, that something had gone wrong that day. I believe that it was a spontaneous eruption, just like the theft was. Maybe it was an impulse. I didn't know. And I was really in that kind of denial, believing that, well, maybe he was there, but I bet he really didn't hurt anybody. Or maybe they were doing a prank and somebody gave him live ammunition and he didn't know it. I mean, I know these things sound foolish, but that is where I was and what I believed.
I skipped a step here.
Sure.
When we were talking about it, you found out from the SWAT team member that Dylan was dead. But when did you find out that he actually was one of the shooters that had killed people?
By that evening, I don't know what time during the day, but as the day progressed, the police were telling us that they believed that Dylan was one of the shooters. So as the day was progressing, I learned that. And I don't remember exactly at what point in the day. But by evening, we had gone to someone's house to stay, and it was on the news, and his picture was on television. But even knowing that he was a perpetrator of whatever happened, I was still very confused about what his role was. And there was this conflict in me of accepting, yes, Dylan did a horrible thing, a multitude of horrible things, but he was my son, and he that wasn't who he was. And so it was a long time. Eventually, 6 months after the shootings, the sheriff's report finally came out to identify what had actually happened, who had done what, who had killed whom. And I remember going into that meeting and seeing the tapes that the boys had made that I didn't even know they existed, and being in tremendous shock. I remember standing up. I thought I was going to be sick. I mean, I just was just sick all over. I didn't know what to do. And then I learned the reality that this had been planned, that it was their goal to kill everyone in the school, and they had not failed to, and they had failed to do that, thank goodness. So that at that 6 point mark was where I think my, you know, the world had collapsed, yes, but it just went into a deeper abyss after that to try to accept the reality of what happened.
When you saw that video, you actually, as you said, you were almost literally sick.
Yeah.
But you saw a Dylan that you didn't recognize, that, I mean, he was especially cruel.
Right.
And had actually made some racist remarks.
It was hard to understand a lot of it. He was a mumbler. It was hard to understand, but it was, and I don't want to talk too much about the video because I don't want to promote copycatting. The less people can model about this, the safer it is for all of us. But they were talking about their intention, their hatred, and what I was seeing in Dylan. What appeared to be posturing for me. It appeared to me that he was talking tough and trying to act tough in front of Eric. And I remember Eric telling him to, you know, feel the rage. And Dylan would try to find things that he was angry about and talk about that. But it was still a side of him that I had never seen, and it was shocking to see.
When you say that Eric Harris was telling him to feel the rage,
yeah.
And you on that video that the two of them had made, I mean, you described some things that I mean, he was going back to his childhood, early childhood, and when you say posturing, it would seem like he was almost desperate to come up with something to be angry about.
Exactly the way I felt about it, because I remember, and so often we do this, especially when we lose loved ones to suicide, we go back and sort of analyze every moment we spent with them, and we think, I must have done something I wasn't aware of. And I was very focused on, you know, for many months, just searching, thinking, oh, I bet it was that time when he was 3 years old that I put sprinkles on his birthday cake instead of decorating it. Or, you know, oh, I bet it was that time. And because you really are just grasping at some way to explain what is inexplicable. And yes, I looked at his childhood, and very often school shooters have a history of trauma in their past, some kind of childhood abuse or traumatic situation. I, to this day, am not aware of any trauma that he might have experienced. He did have surgery as a baby. He was an infant. He was like 2 or 3 weeks old. That was the only thing that I was aware of. If there were other things, something happened without my knowledge.
In those 6 months between the shooting and when you saw the videotape, and I mean, it goes beyond 6 months.
Yeah.
But talk about your state of mind. I mean, this is something, the word I keep hearing from people when I talk about you being on the program today is unimaginable. In fact, we've got an email saying that someone is overwhelmed,
yeah.
that other people just can't imagine the state of mind you were in, the pain you were going through, just what was life like in the time after the shooting.
It is so hard to describe because I don't think there were words in my vocabulary to describe the state that we were in. My son is now in his early 40s, and he looks back, and I said, you know, how would you describe what we went through? And he said, there's only one word. It was hell. And that's the way I feel about it, because My heart was broken. I felt terrible sorrow for the victims' families, for the people who had been injured and would have lifelong injuries and expenses and pain and disfigurement. There were deaths of innocent children, and I saw photos in the paper of their parents attending their funerals. And I, too, had lost my youngest child and didn't understand why, and it couldn't make sense of it. But when there is something like a murder-suicide, when there was a violent event and the perpetrator takes his own life, it's a very bifurcated, forked trauma, because not only do you have your own sorrow, but there was world attention and blame. Our governor got on national television to say this was the parents' fault. There was so much anger. Eventually, our family was sued by 36 families. So it was a long, long period of incredible stress and fear. I considered changing my name. I considered moving. But what I realized was that all the support that I had was right there in Denver, all my colleagues and friends. And I knew that if I left and moved away, I would lose that support. So I stayed there. I began therapy. I had years of therapy. About 4 years after the tragedy, when we were getting ready for the depositions, I started having a real acute anxiety disorder and panic attacks. Got that under control. The depositions, they were settled through a large settlement in which all the funds from all the insurance companies were pooled and distributed to all the victims. And about 2 years later, during that time, I had been trying to understand how Dylan died and why, and I kept going back to his own suicidality. On a very abstract level, I can understand rage if one is bullied or humiliated. I can understand impulsivity, but I had trouble wrapping my arms around his taking his own life, because he didn't seem like somebody who would ever do that. He wanted to travel, and he seemed to have so much to look forward to. I became more and more involved with the suicide prevention community and learned more and more about suicide. And ultimately, the police did give us some writings. And in those writings, I read something he'd written when he was 15 years old. And he wrote, "I am in agony. I want to get a gun. I want to kill myself." And he referred to himself as Cutting. And he said, "I became Mr. Cutter tonight." And that was really another one of many, many shocks and thresholds of learning that I had to go through. So there are hundreds of touch points where if I can get through this, then whatever's coming next, I had to get through that and then get through that. And in the mix there, I got breast cancer a couple years after the shootings too. So it was just a lot of stuff. And I look back at all the people who loved and supported me and took care of me and protected me. I have so much gratitude for friends and family and, you know, our attorney and, you know, all the people who were forming a little cocoon around us because we couldn't endure watching the news or hearing what was being said. Mm. That was a long haul.
So what did you think of Dylan? And what were your feelings, your emotions toward Dylan?
Up until the police gave us the report 6 months after his death, I was very confused, but sympathetic. My love for Dylan was unwavering. I believed that something had happened. I didn't understand what. You know, I still didn't get it. But when I saw those tapes, when I saw the posturing and the anger and the brandishing of weapons and bragging, I did for a moment hate him. I mean, I was so angry at him. And I think that was a phase I had to go through to get past that. One thing that I have learned over the years is that when people are in a suicidal state, when they have reached a point of life indifference or certainly the desire to end that life's pain, I always thought that before that when someone died and took their own lives, that they made the choice to do that or the decision to do that. And in doing so much research and talking with so many people who were attempt survivors and lost survivors, I really learned that one is in an impaired state when they are that far along on that path. And I began to see that Dylan was not in control of his thoughts. He had lost access to his tools of self-regulation and morality at that point. And there was much more to it than I'm deciding I'm going to do a school shooting. I'm deciding that I'm going to kill myself. Because we use that word decision-making and choice and apply it to our conscious state of how we think we would be. But their state is in a very different place. And that was part of my understanding and my being able to not stay angry and not hate him.
You love him?
I love him dearly.
When you think of Dylan, what do you think of?
I still think of that child. I have dreams about him all the time. And always, he's that very cherubic youngster. I have many, many nightmares still. Very often, my nightmares are, I see him and I haven't seen him in many years, and I fear that he's been neglected, or that in one dream, I dreamed that I was getting him ready for bed, and hidden under his clothes were all these cuts and scars, and I didn't see them. I have dreams that I realize he's been in his room for, 20 years, and I haven't cared for him. And so a lot of caretaker guilt, negligence guilt, I have those dreams. I have dreams that he's in danger. He's up on a high precipice, and I'm trying to get to him and save him so he doesn't fall off. So in my mind, in my subconscious as well as my consciousness, I tend to think of him as a youngster.
So, Sue, we talked about the aftermath of the shooting. One of the questions that I know you were asked very, very often, mm-hmm. and people around the country, around the world, ask this question. Mm-hmm. How could you not know?
How could you not know? That came in some of the hate mail that was sent to us, something written in big black markers. How could you not know? And of course, that was the question I was asking myself. I didn't have an answer for that. Now, many years later, I think I'm better equipped to answer that question. For those who die by suicide, and this, again, I want to clarify that murder-suicide is still a very rare event, even though we hear about it a lot in the news. Of murder-suicides, only about 1% to 2% of all suicides involve taking another person's life. And within that category, mass shootings are the least likely to happen. So statistically, we're talking about a very small number of people. But those of us who have lost loved ones to suicide, about half of us don't know that our loved ones are contemplating suicide, are preoccupied with suicidal thoughts. About half of us know that they are struggling, and very often they've been in and out of care. Maybe they've been hospitalized. And it is not uncommon for people not to know. And that is because the individual works so very hard to not show what they are thinking and feeling. And Dylan was a very smart person, and he was a very, I wouldn't say he wasn't flat, but he was not an exuberant person. He was a reserved person. And I think it was easier for him to keep up that facade and wear that mask that things are all right. There are many reasons why someone might hide that they are thinking about suicide. And one of the main reasons is historically, we have always viewed suicidal thoughts as a character flaw. It's a weakness. There's something wrong with you. You can't handle your own problems. We have all these judgments about people who are having suicidal thoughts. And the individual who is struggling also has those same judgments about him or herself. So it's something people tend to hide out of their own sense of self-esteem. Also, there is a phenomenon that occurs where there's this kind of ambiguity about it, where they think, I'm not really suicidal. Yes, I think about it a lot, but I'm not really suicidal. And it's that, it's kind of like, how do you know if you are addicted to substances? You may be, but you may not identify that way. And that occurs with suicidality as well.
But your son's suicide was much different than many others in that it wasn't just a suicide. Right. It was a planned mass murder.
Right.
And again, let me talk about even some evidence that the police found afterwards. Mm-hmm. You did not have guns in your home, correct?
Correct.
In fact, Dylan asked you for a gun for, was it Christmas?
He asked me for a gun for Christmas. And that was the last Christmas he was alive. And I was surprised and shocked. And I said, Dylan, you know, what do you want a gun for? And he said, well, I want it for target practice. And I said, well, you've got a BB gun. Why don't you use that? And of course, I got the eye roll because he said, it's not the same thing. And I remember saying to him, well, you're going to be 18 on your next birthday. I said, you're going to be an adult soon. If guns are something you want in your life, you can do that. But you know, I am never, ever going to buy you a gun. And he smiled and he said, I know. I just thought I'd ask. After his death, I learned that at the time he was asking me was when a very large gun show was in town. And he had the intention of buying a gun and wanted to see if I would buy it for him. And of course, I did not. But he was able to obtain a gun.
How?
He obtained two guns, one legally and one illegally. The one he obtained legally was he went to the gun show, he and Eric, and they went with Dylan's friend, who was a girl. Her name was Robin. And she purchased the shotgun for Dylan because she was 18 years old. And she gave it to him, and he paid her the money. It's called a straw purchase. No one had broken a law. So that was obtained legally. I don't know how Dylan got it into my house. I don't know where he hid it. To this day, I don't know where it was. It's one of those many, many things I wish I could ask him. The other gun he obtained from a young man who was selling one of his own firearms. And this young man thought that Dylan was 18 because he knew that he'd gone to the gun show. And Dylan was also a graduating senior. But Dylan had entered school a year early because he was a gifted kid. And this man didn't know that Dylan was only 17. And he sold him one of his guns. And the young man got a 6-year prison sentence.
You have mentioned Eric Harris's name several times throughout the program. Mm-hmm. You also mentioned that Dylan had a lot of friends. Eric Harris, if you ranked how close he was, probably was third or fourth on Dylan's list. Right. What role did Eric Harris play in this?
I don't know. I cannot clearly define the role. I believe that the two of them were connected in some kind of way that was that kind of encircled them both and pulled them in. I do know that there was one bullying incident at school in which the two of them were shoved around, ketchup was squirted on them. They were isolated from all their friends. Nobody saw it. No one that Dylan knew saw it. But I do remember Dylan coming home from school one day with ketchup on his shirt. And I asked him, what happened to you? And he said, I've just had the worst day in my life. I don't even want to talk about it. Well, he was a young adult, and I thought, you don't have to talk about it if you don't want to. And again, I regret that because I know now that it takes much more skill at listening and pulling information. And I wasn't aware of that, and I wasn't aware of the need of it. But I think if that wasn't the thing that cemented their rage and their secrecy and their tendency toward wanting revenge, I don't know of another incident. That's the one I'm aware of. And I think I don't remember which came first, that or the arrest. About that time they were arrested together. That was another thing that pulled them close together. They had very different personalities. They had very different psychological tendencies and issues. Eric, and I don't know officially what his diagnosis was, but he was having some professional help. He had created a website. It was extremely violent, almost manic. It was graphic and gory and very homicidal. And Dylan was apparently aware of that because he told someone about it. And Dylan and his writings were all very internal. Dylan wrote about himself being lonely. He showed more depressive symptoms in his writing, more inwardly focused, and he talked about suicide. So whatever this magnetism was, whatever they did together. I believe that their double involvement was one of the things that propelled it forward. And we had, on the one hand, a suicidal kid and a homicidal kid who both felt humiliated, indignant, enraged, and it morphed into this.
What advice would you have for parents?
The advice that I give most often is it's quite simple. It's shut up and listen. The children we have are suffering. It's very unlikely they are planning violence towards someone else, but it is somewhat highly likely that they are planning violence or contemplating violence toward themselves. The most important things that we can do as a parent is to listen without judgment, without trying to fix it, to not try to help them feel better, but just to help them feel.
Tomorrow's special edition broadcast is with former federal judge John Jones, whose 2014 ruling made same-sex marriage legal in Pennsylvania. I'm Scott Lamar.